Hey, we're recording. Welcome back, Barely Legal Comedy Podcast people. So there's a slight whistle on Mr. Keogh's end, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, that was an interesting way of putting it. But yeah. Basically, one of the lights in my office is a bit broken and it's creating a constant sort of like electrical buzzing sound, like quite high pitched as well. It's sort of like being tortured, you know what I mean?
A little bit.
Really annoying. Yeah, but I've got I've logged a thing with the maintenance people, so they're going to come and fix it hopefully at some point.
But yeah, hopefully before you retire in 25 years' time.
Yeah, ideally.
I wouldn't hold my breath. That would be a good like strap line It's like being tortured.
Exactly.
It's like being tortured.
It's like being tortured. I've just had an email from the maintenance people and they aim to complete my request by Friday, the 31st of May.
Really? So. That's all right. So what's that, a month?
In about 6 weeks' time, yeah.
6 weeks.
And at that point, I won't be teaching. I'll be at home, so I'm not really bothered about it at that stage. Anyway, there we go.
Right, so I'm utterly... Did you release that one you did on your own? Because I think I retweeted it.
Yeah, I did. I talked about imposter syndrome for like half an hour or so on my own. Yeah.
I couldn't listen because I had very sporadic Wi-Fi, like I'm talking about 10 to 20 minutes a day when it would connect. And then when it connected, it was so unbelievably bad. Like my emails used to take about 5 or 10 minutes to download, and then they wouldn't even download the message. They'd just download the headline. So I absolutely couldn't listen. There's been zero feedback from anyone, which I used to take as a bad sign, but now that's a really good sign.
I got feedback personally. I got a few messages from people saying they really liked it. Yeah. So, and from people that I don't normally get, you know, they're not the usual suspects who give us feedback. Right. Yeah. So it was quite nice. Yeah.
Ooh. Well, if you want to branch off on your own, if you want to take over, so it's really good to be back. I saw something on Twitter in the last day or two that's not really criminal, but I'm sure you know something about it. Hugh Grant has been suing, I don't know which paper exactly. I know it's some of the Murdoch ones, so I'm guessing it's primarily The Sun, but possibly The Times as well. And he's been suing them for a good few years on the back of invasion of his privacy, the fact that he alleges they broke into his house, they've been bugging his devices. I think Steve Coogan alleged something similar. I think loads of people, including Prince Harry, also said the similar sort of thing. And there was a bit of a resolution in that yesterday. So do you know anything about that? Because it's not your area.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was actually looking at it on the train coming into work this morning, believe it or not, so coincidentally. So it's been going on for a while, like you say, because I remember he changed his name on Twitter to Hacked Off Hugh, didn't he? Like, he started like a Hacked Off sort of, I think that was like a campaign group that he sort of started, basically to bring this matter to the fore. And yeah, and it's been going on for ages, hasn't it? It was like the Levinson inquiry or something that was part of it, and that was at least 5 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was before COVID, anyway. So yeah, it's been going on for a while, and he tweeted that basically he's had to sort of settle the matter out of court, hasn't he? So he was hoping that it would come to, you know, it would go to a trial. You know, his claim against them, I assume for damages for invasion of privacy and so on. And I think it was a matter of principle, you know, like I don't think he's doing it for the money.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Levison Report, chaired by Lord Justice Levison, appointed in July 2011, held in 2011 and 2012, so it's 13 years ago, about 12 years ago, the Press Complaints Commission. So it's Cameron who was Prime Minister at the time. Right, that's just according to Wikipedia, but that's a long time.
Yeah, it's been going on for a long time, yeah. And ultimately, what's happened yesterday is that, is it News Group newspapers, aren't they? So in the Law Gazette, They refer to them as the Sun Publisher News Group newspapers, which suggests that it was the Sun primarily that was the newspaper that he was after. But obviously they're owned by News Group, who are basically Rupert Murdoch's company. So they're, you know, as the parent company, that's who you would issue the claim against rather than the Sun per se. So he, so they are basically offered him money to settle the claim. This is what happens in civil claims. Yes. So,
and they offered him a lot of money, didn't they? A ridiculous amount.
Yeah, which he's not, he's not sort of said what it was, has he? I assume he won't be allowed to sort of publish that.
No. I've got 10 million in my head. I don't know where from, because I was reading Hugh Grant's comments. And
yeah,
there's a ridiculous amount of money mentioned, maybe 10 million, maybe more.
So 10 million is the estimated costs that might have accrued,
he
basically.
He will be liable for. Have I got that right?
Tell me,
because I'm a bit confused.
So what it is, it's a Part 36 offer, okay? So Part 36 of, that refers to, Part 36 of the civil procedure rules, okay?
Right.
Which basically allows for... So just to take it back a step. So what happens with the civil claim is that someone will issue a claim against someone. They'll say, like, you've caused me harm to this tune, you know, of X number of pounds by your actions.
Yeah.
And I want you to pay me this amount to settle, you know, to compensate me for the damages that I've suffered. And you know, and there might be other things as well, but let's keep it simple and make it like a money claim. And then what will happen is that that claim will be issued and it will be served on the defence. This is following actually initial letters, like where you outline what your claim is going to be about as part of the pre-action protocol, and you allow the other side to maybe make you an offer before you even issue the claim. You know what I mean? Like you you have to follow that process. And behave reasonably and so on. So you have to give people pre-warning that you're going to issue a claim unless they remedy it. So if someone like, say, wrote to you and said, actually, Alex Boardman, you have caused me damages because of your dreadful behaviour as regards this, your party wall between our properties or something. And you can say, all right, well, sorry, I didn't realise that. Thanks for letting me know. Here's some money to rectify that problem, and then that solves the issue, and then they don't need to issue the claim. If you, however, say, actually, no, I disagree with this, you know, do your worst. I'm not accepting responsibility for this. They can then choose to issue the claim, and at that point, that gets the ball rolling. They will have to outline what the claim is about in their particulars of claim, you know, which goes into greater detail as to the sort of structure of, you know, the nature of it is, and actually what it's about. And then you can, as the defendant, you can reply to that and outline your case. And then it goes to court and it gets allocated, you know, to a track, depending on, which means whether, if it's like for a minimal amount, it'll be on the small claims. If it's like slightly more, then it'll be on the fast track. And if it's a big claim, it'll be on the multi-track, which is what this will have been. You know what I mean? This was a big claim.
Yeah.
So it's there's a lot involved in it, and there's a lot of work that goes on. There's lots of writing between solicitors. You know, it becomes, I would say, a lawyer-driven thing at times, because of how it works. There's lots of rules. Okay, now one of the, and it's all governed by the civil procedure rules, so you have to comply with those, which were brought into effect in 1998. And anyone who studied law, like done an LPC or the BTC, and has had to learn about the CPR, which is what, you know, the shorthand for the civil procedurals, knows that it's like, it's horrific, you know what I mean? It's like, there's so many rules, okay? But Part 36 of this, and there's all different parts, and it deals with literally everything, like how to issue a claim, what you have to do in response. It sets, you know, deadlines for responding to things and for issuing things and all of that. Everything is in there. And one of the parts of it is Part 36, which is an offer to settle. So at the end of this whole process, as you approach trial, you know, as you've got to the point where we both know what our case is and we've both considered it, the defendant has the opportunity to offer to settle the claim, to say, right, I will give you X amount of pounds for you to sort of like go away and to settle this, and if you accept this money, then that means you can't proceed with the claim, and then it all disappears. Okay.
Yeah.
Now that under Part 36, if that offer is made under Part 36, then what the risk is that if that offer is not accepted, okay. So when you get made an offer, you have a choice. You don't have to accept it. You can choose to ignore it if you think actually that doesn't satisfy the damages I've suffered. I want more money than that. Let's take it to court. That's the, you know, or you can say, all right, fair enough, I will accept that offer. That seems reasonable in the circumstances. That's how it's supposed to work. That's sort of quite simplistic, you know, decision sort of making. But actually, when it's particularly, it's a complicated case like this one, where there's been lots of lawyers involved, like News Group will have appointed the most expensive lawyers in the world, I should imagine, you know what I mean? And therefore the costs at this stage will be really, really high that they've already accrued. Because the risk of a Part 36 offer is that if you turn down the offer, okay, and then you go to court, even if you win your case, so you prove that the damages have accrued and it's their fault, whatever. And then, so there's two things. So like you can win your case, and then there's an argument as to what level of damages should be. And if the judge following the hearing decides to award you a sum of money which is less than the Part 36 offer was, then you are responsible for all of the costs of that case, your own costs and the other side's, even though you've won. And it's meant to encourage people to accept reasonable offers to settle, you know what I mean, to not take things to court. Yeah. On matters of principle or to create work for the court system like that. Now, I can sort of see why they do that. That makes sense in a lot of ways to stop people sort of trundling off and having you know, these sort of, you know, hearings that actually are quite academic in some ways and clogging up the system. Yeah,
because there will be a lot of neighbour disputes, won't there, over a fence.
Yeah, exactly, that sort of thing, yeah. But in this scenario, it does allow for defendants like News Group, who are powerful and wealthy, and have a lot to lose by matters making it to trial. You know what I mean? So and it allows for them to basically avoid negative publicity by so what they've been able to do is they say, like, well, we don't accept liability for this. We don't accept that we did any of these things. However, in order to avoid, you know, they'll pitch it like this. They'll say that litigation is inherently risky because we don't accept we did it, but we still might have lost because that's what happens in court sometimes. And so we made a very reasonable offer to Mr. Grant to settle this case. And he clearly accepted that. And that's how they'll pitch it. They will sort of, and thereby proving our innocence is how they will frame this News Group. Whereas the reality is that, you know, they've probably made him a really high offer. They've made a business decision to say, actually, our reputation is worth more money than this offer is, and therefore this is reasonable for us, from a business point of view, to make this offer to him to get him to go away. And the risk for Hugh Grant is that he's following legal advice. He's clearly said that he was advised that they might struggle to beat the offer at court, and therefore he would end up paying up to £10 million worth in costs. His exact words were, my lawyers tell me that this is exactly what they would most like. So he said, if I proceed to trial and the court awards me damages that are even a penny less than the settlement offer, I would have to pay the legal costs. My lawyers tell me that that is exactly what would most likely happen here. Rupert Murdoch's lawyers are very expensive, so even if every allegation is proven in court, I would still be liable for something approaching £10 million in costs. I'm afraid I am shying at that fence, which is a really lovely way to put it, I think. And actually, Hugh Grant has summed up how Part 36 offers work brilliantly, I would say, in his tweets.
Yeah, he has.
Because
so his second tweet says, News Group are claiming they are entirely innocent of the things I had accused the Sun of doing. Phone hacking, unlawful information gathering, landline tapping, the burglary of my flat and office, the bugging of my car, the illegal blagging of medical records, lies, perjury, and the destruction of evidence. So that's so cleverly summed up by saying these are all the things they say they've not done. But it's kind of I mean, it makes normal people as well. One of my first thoughts here, the way you were summing that all up, is when you think of other famous cases involving civil lawsuits where people have paid off, I'm thinking Michael Jackson as a...
Yeah, I was going to say
that
was...
The very first thing that came into my head as you were summing all that up. And I think there is a stigma now that people hear that you've paid off the money and you've paid the person off. And I don't think anybody really assumes that it's for convenience or for that litigation is inherently, you never know which way it's going to go. I think everyone says, it's just hush money. That's what it feels like.
Prince Andrew as well, paying off that accuser, you know what I mean, to keep it out of court.
Yeah, those are the big two.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, as Hugh Grant says, as is common with entirely innocent people, they are offering me an enormous sum of money to keep this matter out of court.
I really like him. I just thought he was, the characters he played in in the 90s, I suppose, he was always this sort of twit, wasn't he? This kind
bumbling fop. Yeah, that's what he was,
and
wasn't
then he's
he?
I've got this bookshop in Notting Hill. I never sell a book, and my rent's £7,000 a month. It's Julia Roberts now. I spilt my coffee on her. And to be honest, there's a lot of rich comedians who seem to follow that career path. I'll do a jolly little open spot at the Frog and Bucket. Oh, I got booed off. I'm on the Apollo. And you get how's this happened? I don't know. It just so he really used to annoy me, but he I think I was totally wrong about him. You forget sometimes, or I used to forget, with actors that
they're acting. They're playing a role. Yeah, yeah. No, he seems really sound and really switched on, doesn't he? I think. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But so he summed it up really well, and that is the risk. It's sort of what is it's a concept. I don't know if you've heard of this, called lawfare. So it's like a play on warfare, which is like using the sort of systems, like the justice systems, whether that's civil or criminal, usually civil or family sometimes as well. And how actually, if you're wealthy enough, you can use that. You can abuse that system. You know what I mean? And you can do that. So, you know, Part 36 is necessary. You know what I mean? You need it, but it does allow it does allow for people like News Group to effectively keep certain information out of the court. So, like I say, I think everyone will think they clearly have done this and they didn't want it all to come out. But
it's still an abstract concept that in my head it's kind of
it's still an abstract.
We did burgle his flat. Oh, they probably did get his medical records. Now, if you and if you knew the details,
we don't know the exact details exactly. If it keeps the detail out.
You'd be like, oh my god, that's horrific.
Yeah, exactly. But
the people that buy the Sun still buy the Sun.
Will
always buy the Sun.
I can't understand why anybody would, but it's absolutely. You know, ignoring the sort of like the morals and the ethics and everything of their reporting and of their practices and so on, is that it's just crap as well, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
like, did they still have page
it's
three?
Like, I think they got rid of that, didn't they? I think they got rid of page three.
Because that would be the only sort of reason, like when I was very young. Yeah, so the Sun had Hagar the Horrible, that was like this sort of Viking character. And they had page three, and then they maybe had the showbiz page, which might have been Gary Bushell or somebody like that. I think Frankie Boyle actually wrote for the Sun for a bit. But when you're a bit little,
he did, surprisingly,
he did. And then there's there are always reasons when you're younger and you're not really interested in news, when you're like 10 or something, and you're like, oh, I like this cartoon, or I like this bit, or I like that bit. So then that would make the paper better than the Mirror, for instance. But then when you get older, surely you're not as bothered about Hagar the Horrible cartoon. And nowadays, I mean, if you can't find a nipple to look at your own convenience in colour, it's like, well, I just don't know who. But then, of course, when you do, I did a gig in Bolton last week. At a conservative club, and it was kind of all right, but there was one or two like real idiots in. Not, and I don't mean they were conservative, although I'd imagine they probably were. but they were like really dumb,
yeah,
like just knobs. Most of the people there were absolutely lovely, and they looked like conservatives sort of used to look in the 80s and 90s, where they had like jumpers on and shirts and ties under a jumper. And you know, it really
smelled. Right, okay.
And they were lovely. They were just really nice. And then there were like one or two like loads of money types in who were absolutely.
All right, yeah.
And so you go, yeah. they'll probably buy it like forever, you'd think, because of the political tone and the fact that, you know, people like Jeremy Clarkson, don't they? I find him an amusing figure, but
yeah.
I don't think he means 90% of what he says.
I know. I think he's clearly sort of. I think he's quite mischievous half the time. But
totally.
But in a world where there's people that have taken that sort of shtick and made, you know, and got into high office with it, it's like it's not quite the same sort of like almost like innocent bit of mischief making anymore, is it? That sort of, you know,
no.
you know, like for example, if you look at how people drive. Past cyclists, like some people are like I've ridden a bike on the roads, and some people could like properly like cut you up like almost deliberately, and I think a big part of that is Clarkson demonizing cyclists, you know what I mean, like he's made that a more mainstream view, so you've got to be sort of careful with your sort of bullshit, don't
See,
you
I, think, you know? I so. Think a big part of that is that cyclists are ridiculously annoying as well.
There's always two
sides to this kind of
actually what argument. It is though is because the infrastructure in this country is shit is what it is, and we're forcing too many people into the same space, I think is the real issue.
So you're saying stop immigration, that's what you're saying. I finally get you.
So you know what I mean, it's like. But yeah, there's always two sides to every story, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but it's interesting though. Like people, I'm just looking on the Law Gazette website here in some of the comments, and someone's made a comment about how actually this is really, you know, it's making the points that we do. So in the US, it's even worse, of course, with like Epstein types buying off vulnerable victims and even serving an agreed year in a comfortable prison of their choice. That sort of thing. But he made the point, said like Part 36 offers are why you don't see many lying defendant stories in PI cases hitting the news. So PI is personal injury. I've seen many, many shameful lies from defendants. And when you pull their pants down on witness statement exchange, disclosure, or sooner, you invariably receive a Part 36 offer too good and risky to refuse.
Yeah.
You know, so you basically, you can sort of say to them, because you have to do this up front, you know, before you get to court, Once you reveal to them, like, I know that you are lying about this, they will, after receiving legal advice, they'll make an offer that's reasonable and that you've got to take it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you never get to have that sort of day in court of showing them, you know, showing them up, I guess. That's how the system's sort of meant to work, though. You know, so
So another thing that's sort of coming into my mind here, which I'm sure we will at some point in the very long future do an episode on, is Everton Football Club being docked. I can't remember what they were docked initially. It was 10 points, then that was reduced to 6.
10 points.
And then was it 8, then reduced to 2, or 6, then reduced to
then
2?
There's an extra, like, 2, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
And that's been dealt with really swiftly because Everton haven't really blocked it. I mean, they are appealing, but they haven't blocked it. And then you compare that...
They admitted the offences, didn't they? So
I know a few people, because of COVID, a few teams fell foul of financial fair play and just went yes, it was because of COVID, we were shut. when we'd have made money on tickets, we didn't make money on tickets, so all our accounting was based on, we'll make £10 million in the next 6 months, and we only made 2 because of COVID.
And that's fair enough as well, I think. You know what I mean? Like you've got to make financial projections, and then there's something completely unprecedented that happens couldn't have legislated for.
No,
you know?
And I think that's why they've just been fined. But then the whole sort of, every time I watch Man City on the telly, it's kind of really hard to watch football anyway at the moment, because the rules have changed so much when you're watching a game that at any point you could be really enjoying a match. I can't think of like a big match, one of the 3-3s or a 4-3 or a there's not been one decision in, like a penalty's given for absolutely nothing, and you go, oh, that's the game's just gone.
Yeah, or not given for something that was a penalty last week. You know what I mean? You think, yes. What are the actual rules like? You know.
So it's really, really difficult to watch. Anyway, and then I remember, oh God, that whistling. So sorry about this whistling, everybody. How can you be expected to work like that, sit in that office for 8 hours? It's like torture having that go off. Yeah. It's really, really bad. But
I know. I'll have to go and find somewhere else to sit, like a cafe or something.
Yeah, yeah. But so then you watch City knowing they've got these 115 charges. And about 15, 20 years ago, Juventus did something similar where there were allegations of match fixing and paying off referees. And that turned out to be true. And they stripped them of all the titles that they'd won.
And relegated them, didn't they?
Yeah. So I don't think this is like quite the same level, although I don't know because we don't know.
I think it might be.
Very well could be. But then you go, well, everything then in the last 5 or 10 years has been, I mean, as you get older, life starts to feel a little more pointless and you sort of go, God, nothing really mattered after all. But to do that to football, the one thing I always believed in, you feel oh my God. So in 2 or 3 years, we might go, oh, you know, those 10 years of football, they just don't count. It's like,
Exactly. Well, that's it. Yeah. And because it's like, if you want to, you know, if they, like say, for argument's sake, if City did get sort of stripped of their titles, you know, like that they've won over a certain period of time, if it's found that they were actually cheating the system and therefore and had an unfair advantage as a result of that. And therefore they stripped them of the titles, and that means that who finished second is now, they're now the league champions. And it's like, well, I sort of wouldn't want those I'm a Liverpool fan,
rubbish.
so they'd be like so Liverpool would get 2 or 3 extra league titles, but you know it wouldn't really feel like you had won it because you know that you didn't actually finish top of the league, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, there's a couple of them where they finished like a point behind them, like, you know, with a massive number of points and got to a European final, which actually is quite, it's an achievement in itself. But then there's some ones where you finish second where you weren't even challenging.
You're not even close, no, you're 10 points behind.
So it's like,
it's funny how it impacts like real life. And I think there's people on Twitter, because I was just looking when you were telling about Hugh Grant, and there's one or two people going, oh, come on, you should have... He talks the talk, Hugh Grant. Why did he not risk? But say you don't get
whatever the. Why did he not risk £10 million?
No, he's also vowed to give the money straight to a charity. So he's not making a penny out of whatever the settlement is. He's giving it to. Is it Hacked Off? Is that the name of the charity?
That's the name of the organisation,
So he's giving the money straight to them to fight this even more. So, so that's quite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's like people on. The older I get, the more I think that people are just stupid. You know what I mean? Like the people's like views. Like I was like looking at something today. There's a guy I met who goes into my local pub, and he was like quite a nice bloke when I was talking to him. So he sent me a friend request on Facebook.
I met a
Facebook,
couple of people in Bolton who knew you, who came up to me and went, "I go drinking with Keo in Bunbury's."
Oh, right, really?
Before the gig, so I was like, can you sit in the front because you'll be all right.
Oh, cool. And then, like, I don't know, all these posts are like about, you know, like Sadiq Khan and all that. And I've got a view that I think that if you don't live in London and you have strong opinions on Sadiq Khan as being the mayor of London, that's possible because you're racist.
Yes.
You know? So I can't think of any other reason why you would have strong views about who was the mayor of London if you didn't live there. You know what I mean? So yeah, it just, and it's just, you can just see like people have these opinions that are based on false information and biases and so on. And you can see it from a mile off. And I've got to the stage now where it's like, well, what's the point of telling them that though? There like is, they don't care. They don't care that they're wrong. You know what I mean? So I just let them get on with just being wrong about stuff.
It feels
which isn't. Seems like anathema to me. You know what I mean? Because I hate that. I hate sitting there listening to people be wrong about things when I know that I can point out that where they're going wrong. And I used to do that.
The lack of tolerance is.
I know. Yeah. I used to do that, like, and not understand why people would then, like, you know, get annoyed with me, you know, because when I was younger, I used to think, oh no, they're making a mistake. I can help them.
Yes.
Not make that mistake.
To clarify,
you know
what I mean? Your tiny
exactly. You know, do you remember person that wasn't even media, talking to me.
Yeah. When social media sort of first started, I remember specifically on Twitter, and you'd see, it was amazing for news, years ago, 9 years ago. So like, there was a fire or something. I think also the Manchester bomb was another one where the information came so fast that the radio was getting its news. I was listening to it on the radio. As it sort of was unfolding and reading it on Twitter, and it was coming first hand from ambulance workers and taxi drivers, and saying it wasn't this that you think it was. This is what the cause was, and this is how we deal with it. And there's not gunmen running around Manchester. That's it. Do you know what I mean? All these, and you were like, "Yeah, this is great." And then it feels like now there's more. It felt like a truth place. 8 years ago, like a great.
It was for people to sort of fact check wasn't it? It was.
And now it
whereas now it's the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at that attack in Sydney last week. You know where there was that guy who stabbed I think was it 7 people that he killed eventually. Yeah. It was like, you know, and a horrific incident, and like. The number of people that went straight for, oh my God, I can't believe these Islamists are doing this again, without knowing at all who had done this. You know what I mean? And it was like people like Rachel Riley, you know, the countdown numbers lady, who's like, you know, clearly a bit, I don't know, like she has very strong views, let's put it that way. I'm not going to, she seems like she might be quite litigious, so I'm not going to say anything else, to be honest with you. But, she said, and a few other people went straight for, this is what happens when you allow sort of people to protest in support of Palestinians not dying. You know, like that linking that to that, and then it turned out it was like some white surfer dude. You know what I mean? And it was like, well, you know, like, and then the lack of an apology of like going, oh, actually, I made a mistake there. That was my bias showing. Yeah. I'm sorry about that. Which is what you should do. They just double down on it, going, no, well, I might have been wrong, but in a way I was also right. No, you were just wrong, so just admit you're wrong, you know? Well, especially if you're a mathematician, you should know that sometimes you can just be wrong, you know what I mean?
You've got a science degree.
So use it, you know?
But it feels really, like, hard to go on X anymore, as in, I just don't want to... And I wonder, part of me, in the whole conspiracy theory realm starts to go, is this deliberate? And when you go, who's it straight away who goes for the Islamist who did that in the Australian attack, and you're like, well, is it cynical to think that there are like 100 people being paid to tweet that, so it gets endlessly retweeted,
and then
it's just this smokescreen all the time of the truth? So then you'll go, oh, where do I get the truth? Television or the newspapers, which I don't know. I didn't used to think like that 8 years ago. I wouldn't go on X now really to get news about anything like that.
No.
It feels just like I've not got no interest in it. And
no.
And also,
it's just opinion, isn't it?
It is opinion, but it's hard to let go because it becomes increasingly important to have a social media profile for the work that we do, because it's not, feels like that, say I've got 100,000 Instagram followers as opposed to like 300 or 400, whatever I've got, you'd get more gigs. I know for a fact I would get more gigs. I would get different gigs. And I'd get some of the slightly better paid gigs. Whether I was good or not, it's irrelevant whether I was a better comedian or a worse comedian, which is kind of funny. But then that you're invested in it. So it's really hard to walk away from Twitter when we were 10 years ago, or build up a following, or you'll get people will buy tickets, people will buy your books, people will buy this stuff. And they kind of did for a bit. And so you're like, oh, it's odd to just walk away from that and go, oh, this doesn't matter. Funny that Facebook, in some ways, is kind of where it was really just your friends initially, and you can just put, oh, I've just had potato pie for my tea. No, your friends, did you have beetroot? Yes, I did. Do you have brain salad? That's like the one that's lived through it in some ways. I know if you're young, you're probably, you know, 10 different social media sites that I don't. But
yeah,
it's a very odd time.
It's Well, I despise and I'm addicted slightly to social. I'm not addicted to social media anymore. I think I was for a bit, maybe. You know what I mean? Whereas it's because you can't not do it, isn't it? That's the thing.
You can't. You really do feel like you're missing out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my Facebook profile got disabled for a bit, and I got booted off Facebook for some reason. I don't know why. They won't even tell me. And you know. And it actually cost me a load of money because I then wasn't on the forums to see gigs being advertised, it cost me work, and it was and you know, like, but work for not just that immediate time, but for like several months down the line, because how things get booked up, and I had to sort of start again, but I didn't want to do it, so I know because of that process, I now just sort of use it as like almost like a work email account. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's just, I don't know. I hate it, and I hate that it exists. And I think in a lot of ways, we're all better off when we didn't actually know the minutiae of everybody's life.
In what sense? You know what I mean? For me, I really like TikTok. And when I was away, some days I couldn't even get Wi-Fi. In other days, I might get 10 minutes in a 24-hour period and nothing was loading at all, so it wasn't almost really like not having it. And I'm older than some of the other people, like some of the other entertainers, so there were like 20 year olds absolutely going, like the lives were ending, it felt like, because they couldn't get on, they couldn't check the socials, they couldn't talk to the friends, whereas I thought I'd be like, oh well, it don't really bother me. But there were so many times when I was bored, and so many times in a day that you just automatically go and click something and you go, oh, it don't work. Oh, it don't work.
It's
like conditioned within you. And then as soon as I got off and I was in Spain, and I'm like, oh, look, I've got Wi-Fi again because I've got European Wi-Fi. And click on and you're like, oh. And then you look and you go, oh, I've had a coffee. Oh, how long have I been on? An hour and 10 minutes because I've not done it for a month. And I'm nowhere near head as addicted as a 20-year-old would be. But maybe I am. So it's like a very necessary... Possibly. Nobody's bored anymore. I can remember being bored, like, as a kid for, like, days at a time. Sometimes you'd go on, like, a family holiday and you're, like, 13 and you'd be, like, from going there on a coach to arriving and then, like, day three something would interest you and you go, I've been bored for 2.5 days. Whereas you're barely bored for, like, a minute.
But then I also think that you're permanently bored as well at the same time. You know what I mean? True. It's like just scrolling through sort of like torrents of baseless opinion. You know what I mean? And it's like, God, this is tedious. It's like being trapped in a, you know, like you get trapped by sort of some mithering fucker at the pub. It's like choosing to be mithered to death by idiots. You know what I mean? Is what it's like.
It's like the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, you know, which used to annoy me so much, Alice in Wonderland, and that bit where everyone's just, and you'd realise, like, now when you look back and go, oh, well, that's the whole point. It's about being aggravated and nobody's telling the truth, and it's like everybody's, everything's nonsense. And how.
Oh, that change places. Yeah, like, no, stop it. You know what I mean?
But at the time, that used to really annoy me, and I didn't realise that that's what it was supposed to do. Whereas,
I had those conversations with my dad all the time about sort of like films, like going. I was actually, it links quite nicely with Hugh Grant. So we're watching, like, you know, the About a Boy, the film
of
that.
I really like
obviously the Nick Hornby book. And it's really good. It's one of those sort of films that I could just watch over and over again. Yes. You know what I mean? It's sort of. It's good, but not so good that if you watch it too many times, you'll ruin it, if that makes sense.
There's nothing to see, is there, more than what you...
Yeah, sort of, you know, like, yeah, just sort of, I don't know, it's quite indicative of a time as well, you know, it's background music of a film, and it's quite nice.
Well, you know how he's wasting his time? That was a comedian's life 20 years ago, where he goes, four countdowns on, 10:30, Hope yeah. under the Hammers on, and he's breaking his day down into half-hour segments.
Into units, yeah, like a lawyer, he's breaking it into units at
the
time.
That's essentially what being a comedian used to be like. Whereas now, like with social media, you just get up and go, oh, I'll just scroll for 16 hours and then I'll go and get pissed. That's kind of...
Well, and also, it's like, because you can be potentially producing stuff to put out on the internet, you've got at the back of your mind potentially like, oh, I could be being more productive now.
Yes.
When actually it's important to not be productive sometimes and be on input rather than output, you know what I mean? So yes. It's like you just now get loads of people, they're not being creative or artistic, they're just producing, mass producing shit on a regular basis just to make sure that they're hitting algorithms and all that sort of stuff, you know what I mean? And it's just like, it's a bit like dating in the sort of like digital age. I bet that's stressful. You know, when you can be sort of permanently in contact with someone. You know that whole thing of, oh, when do I message them? Whereas in the old days, it'd be like, right, I'll see you next Friday. And then you'd have your week to yourself. And then you'd go and see them again a week later or whatever, you know. And it was days.
I had my haircut yesterday and my barber, who is Italian, has, I'm just wondering, there's no confidentiality. He's saying this. He just said it to the room and stuff. So he's just started. He's Italian. So his mum and dad, our first generation, are Italian. And then he was born here. So he speaks. He's not really spoken Italian for a bit, but he grew up with it. So he speaks, like, let's say 90% Italian. And his new girlfriend is from Rome. And so speaks like, bada, 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 bada. And he's kind of like, he says, I get most of it, but not always every little nuance anymore. Because I'm not really, he's like my age as well. He's like 45. So he's like 5 years younger than me.
So my age then.
Yeah, so he's your age. So he's not really spoke it since he was a kid, and when he learned it probably as a kid. But they were doing really charming things. He said, oh yeah, we went for a meal, and then the other day we went for a walk, and then we did a this. And it was just really lovely because it was like an old-fashioned sort of kind of date, and they'd met on an app, but neither of them really did the app sort of thing, and it just felt really lovely that you could use it like that but then still have like a meaning, well, just like a nice old-fashioned kind of date. And then as it got further on, he was saying that part of the reason that is because they don't quite speak exactly the same language. So she's got very basic English and he's got not perfect Italian. So they can't quite just text each other, and he'll be having to Google the odd word, or, you know, like he'll miss it. Because if you think how we speak to each other, if you don't speak perfect like Lancastrian, you'd miss bits. So if I was like, oh yeah, that was very good, and you'd be like, oh, I didn't think it was very good, I thought it was rubbish, and then straight away you're in an argument. It felt kind of lovely. But then I remember the people when I was younger who were like, played dating by numbers, who'd like be in a nightclub and try and cop off with seven people, knowing they'd cop off with one. Those people, like quagmire. It feels very like, it feels like awful, doesn't it? Like you're trapped in this endless cycle of just your phone constantly going and going, oh, great.
It would do my head in, I'd hate that. When I was younger, I had a girlfriend for a bit who was Italian, and that sort of, she spoke pretty good English, you know what I mean? But like, because she was studying in England, but it's not perfect. And I don't speak perfect English either, was what I discovered, you know what I mean? Because of my accent and my dialect. So she couldn't always understand what I was saying. I could always understand what she was saying. So we spent sometimes we'd just be hanging out, but communicating through other ways, if that makes sense, you know what I mean? By being in each other's presence, and it was really nice, you know what I mean? It was like, let's just have a moment looking at this river, you know, without commenting on it, you know. And it was lovely.
It was funny when he was talking about it yesterday, And I was a little bit jealous when he was saying, "Oh, we went for a meal," and then another day they went for a walk. That was their day. He went for a walk in Macclesfield Forest, Mac Forest, and I was like, "That, oh, I should do that." And then I was like, "Well, no, why would I? Because you're married." I don't mean with somebody else. I mean like, oh, I could. Me and my wife could go for a walk in Mac Forest, and then like, well, it's a bit cold, and you know,
I don't have
a dog anymore. So what's the point? We'll just put Netflix on. It's kind of...
Yeah, well, you do settle into that sort of thing, don't you? Right, there's some background noise here because I'm putting my coat on because I'm getting ready to go. I've just realised my lecture is in...
I knew we wouldn't do
that. My lecture's in a different building.
Oh, God.
So, yeah. Because I was going to talk about joint enterprise, wasn't I? But that's like an hour's worth of conversation just about the law, really. So we'll do that next time because it's quite interesting.
Yes, and we need to meet up because we've still got Gwillsfield's barely legal envelope.
Oh, that's still
not opened, so we need to do a live one. What are you teaching now? What topic?
Oh, it's like a study skills type thing about how to deal with feedback.
I'm just realizing that you're mobile. You at any point in this last 45 minutes, you did not have to be sat next to a light bulb that's making an irritating noise.
Yeah, I've just made that realization as well, to be honest with you. So, I'm currently walking now. So, I could have taken us on a walking tour of the university.
Right. Let's meet up next week and stuff. We're going to go, everybody. Let me save this. Wow! This is like BBC sound effects in an echoey stairwell.
Yeah, yeah. I'm on the stairwell now, yeah.
Yes, I can tell. I love it. This could have been so much better if you'd have done this through the episode. Say goodbye and I'm going to save, and then don't say anything for a bit or it'll accidentally save it again.
Okay, goodbye, everybody.
I pressed the button before you said goodbye, so do it again. I'll press it again. Oh, he's not saying goodbye.
Okay, good. Goodbye. Goodbye.
What's
you hear
an
that echo?
Absolute cock up.